Okay, I would like to invite our next presenter, Marie Clark.
Thank you, Sasha, and thank you for the invitation to speak at this meeting. I'm very pleased to talk on this subject. Spatial dependence is something that a lot of my research is concerned with, statistical modelling of it. What I'm going to talk about particularly today comes more out of my experience as chair of the statistics panel for European Journal of Soil Science, and also in an editorial role in terms of how spatial dependence and independence often crop up and come back to bite people when they start doing research and analysis. Because problems to do with the assumption of independence often emerge in soil science papers or would-be soil science papers, sometimes invalidating the analyses that have been done. Now, they're generally solutions to these problems, unlike some statistical problems, which can be fatal. But having said that, in many circumstances, one always feels that if there'd been earlier attention to the question of spatial dependence, all the work might have been done with greater efficiency. So, there are two particular misapprehensions which crop up, which I want to address. And the first is a fairly general one that perhaps is less common now than it used to be, and that is that assumptions of independence and worrying about them are just one of those fetishes that statisticians have, and that people working in the real world don't need to bother about them, just like they don't need to bother about any other of the assumptions that we make. That's not so common these days, although sometimes it just happens tacitly. The question of independence or dependence is simply ignored. The other issue that sometimes crops up is a statement along these lines that we can't treat soil data as independent ever. And that's because soil variation is spatially dependent. And while there's a nugget of truth in that, it really overlooks the key problem. And I hope that by the end of this talk, those of you who might have some sympathy with that second view will understand why I disagree with it. So what is independence and why does it matter? If we have two variables, we say they're independent if knowing the value of one of them doesn't tell us anything about the value of the second. That's really what it all boils down to. And in all the classical statistical analyses that so often come up, which use ordinary least squares, confidence intervals for a sample mean, for example, this assumption of independence is implicit. And that's because it has this algebraic implication here. We're saying that the expectation of the product of the difference between one variable and its mean and the second variable of its mean is zero. And in this innocent little expression here that everyone learns at their mother's knee or is taught in their Statistics 101 if they don't know it by that stage, in this innocent looking expression for the standard error of the sample mean, this expression here is absolutely implicit. If you want to derive it, you have to go through this. So this is really my point about the assumption of independence not being a statistician's fetish. It actually comes into the derivation of this enormously widely used expression. So we can't just ignore it. Now, a common source of misapprehensions, perhaps, is the fact that independence is not an assumption we make about data. Rather, it's an assumption we make about a random variable, which is a component of our data. So for three cases, here we have simple random sampling. We treat our data as a random variable, with the component being a mean and then some deviation from that mean. With stratified random sampling, we have our data for ith observation in the jth stratum is given by a mean plus the stratum effect plus another random component. Or if we've done simple random sampling and then fitted a regression model, our observations are given in terms of some sort of predictor, a set of regressors plus coefficients plus a random term. And the point about our assumption of independence is that in each case it's about this component on the end, that random component assumed to be a part of our data. So if we consider two observations, two soil samples drawn from a field. We take them away, analyze them for particle size, and I tell you the first one has got 80% clay. We probably expect that the second one won't be 10% clay, unless it's an extremely variable field. So knowing what your first clay sample is tells you something about the second just by general pedological common sense. Nonetheless, the assumptions of independence still hold if they're randomly drawn samples, because the assumption of independence is about that random component there and not the mean. Now, the next topic that I just want to touch on before we get right into the meat of all this is to do with spatial dependence, and this is just to remind those of you who've forgotten about covariance and the variogram. When we're studying spatial dependence and soil using geostatistics, we propose yet another model for the random variables we're dealing with. And what we do is say that the extent to which any two observations of a random variable are correlated depends on the interval in space between them. So we can say the covariance for observation I and J is given as some function of this lag interval, which separates them, the expectation, again, of this product of two random deviations. By contrast, or rather in relation to that, we can calculate the variogram, half the expected squared difference, which is related in a simple way to the covariance function. So these are the functions we use to capture the spatial dependence of random variables. And here, just to illustrate it, is a variable. This, in fact, is an extract from a Landsat image of northwest Kenya. And this is the variogram of that image. And it shows you the spatial dependence of that variable in that the semivariance is increasing markedly with distance. This means that the covariance is declining with increasing distance. Now, what I want to do with this image to illustrate some of my points about independence is to treat it as a population that we're going to sample. And we're going to sample it in two ways. The first is by simple random sampling. So under simple random sampling, each of those pixels in the image has an equal probability of being included in my sample. So I include, I select 45 pixels independently and at random. Knowing that I've sampled one of them tells me nothing about the probability of sampling any of the others. My second sampling scheme is using random transects. So what I now do is select 9 locations, again independently and at random, on the image. And then having done that, I select another 4 locations in a transect running north-south with an interval of 3 pixels. And there's an element of randomization in that the initial starting points of the transects are selected randomly, but there isn't independence in that knowing where the starting point of a transect is tells me where a further 4 of those samples are going to be drawn from. In each case, as you see, my sampling scheme has 45 points. So here's a simple random sample drawn from the image, and here's a set of 9 random transects of 5 each. Now, what I've done is to repeat each of those sampling schemes 10,000 times. And then in each case, I've taken those 45 observations and I've calculated the sample mean and the sample variance by the usual formulae that you see there. There's nothing extraordinary about those. And then in each case, I've calculated the 90% confidence interval for the mean from that sample mean and variance. Now, of course, I know what the population mean is. So in each case, I say, does that population mean fall in my 90% confidence interval or not? So the confidence interval, again, calculated in the usual way. And, of course, you'll remember that all those old calculations I'm doing have been based on an assumption of independence. So here are the results from that. I've got some statistics, and then I'm presenting my results for the random transects and the simple random sampling, and here I give you the population values. And you'll notice that all the means, or the means for both my sampling schemes, are coming out pretty close to the population mean. Simple random sampling has given me a pretty good estimate of the variance of the population, but I've rather markedly underestimated the variance by my simple, by my random transect sampling. And you see the implications of that. Look at my coverage of my 90% confidence interval, how often it includes the true mean, almost bang on the nose at 0.9 for simple random sampling, but my confidence interval only includes the true mean a little under 60% of the time when I'm using my random transects. Now, we know that our mean is being estimated pretty much without bias, so the source of this poor performance of the confidence intervals is coming from that underestimation of the variance, and I'm sure you realise the root of that is from assuming independence where the sampling scheme was anything but. So, two things to note. We had a population in which there was strong spatial dependence. But when we sampled it by an independent random sampling scheme, everything following on our assumptions of independence worked fine. However, when we sampled without that independence built in through the sampling, we got into trouble. And that really deals with those two misapprehensions. First, I can't ignore this question of independence. But second, it doesn't matter what the underlying structure of the variable is. What matters is how I sample it. So this really is the thing to put on your bumper sticker if your bumper's long enough. The assumption of independence is not justified by the properties of the variable under study. For example, the lack of spatial dependence. It's only justified by how we sample it. Some of your American cars might have wide enough bumpers for that. My British one doesn't. So, if and only if we sample independently at random can we assume independence. We can assume independence in the analysis of data, even if there's strong spatial structure to be found out there in a survey to look for it, provided we've sampled independently and at random. So the independence and randomization in a sampling scheme is captured by a design. And that has to be fully specified in the further analysis. But this really is the key thing to remember. And it was thanks to Jaap de Gaeta in particular that this has been brought home to soil scientists getting carried away with geostatistics, that actually we can go back to these basic principles and assume independence of our sampling is correct. Design-based sampling, then, is where our independence comes from. It justifies the assumptions of independence, and it has other good things about it, too. It's an unbiased, it provides unbiased estimates of mean values. So really, if what your job is to go out and estimate the mean value for some variable across a region, then there's nothing better than a design-based sampling scheme to do it. Why are you sampling on all these grids and doing geostatistics? He said, as an enthusiastic proponent of geostatistics. Really, soil scientists should be using these simple, straightforward design-based sampling schemes a lot more often than they do. But, of course, we can't always. We can't always use these design-based approaches. One reason might be that there may be many objectives to the survey that we're participating in, the study that we're advising on. There might be the need to produce some maps, in which case some sort of a regular sampling scheme is necessary. Furthermore, we might be thinking about using some model-based design for fitting or for estimating regressions for prediction, like the response surface methods. They're good reasons for doing that. And often, of course, very often, we're working with legacy data, data collected in the past for other purposes, or maybe data collected in the past when the design was written down on the back of an envelope which someone has lost, so we don't know what it was. So in those circumstances, what do we do? Well, the solution is to model the spatial dependence. And what we work with is the linear mixed model, so that we treat our observations as a random variable. There's something which gives us a mean value. So this is a design matrix. It might have a set of dummy variables telling us what soil map unit we're in, or it might have some remotely sensed measurements that we're using as covariates. This is a set of predictor coefficients that we will estimate, and then there's a random term. And what we say about this random term now is we're not assuming it to be independent. We assume it has some dependence structure, some covariance function that we can use, a function of the interval between the locations with a set of parameters. And those parameters are the things that those of you who've read geostatistics papers will be familiar with, nugget variance, sill variance, the range, the anisotropy, and so on. And the best way in general to estimate these parameters is by residual maximum likelihood. That's because there's uncertainty in these regression coefficients, or generally these fixed effects coefficients, and that will propagate through into bias in our estimate of any of these variance parameters otherwise. And REML, residual maximum likelihood, minimizes that bias. So I want to give you an example of this. This is from some data from the Vale of the White Horse, and these are real legacy data. They were collected in the 1960s by Peter Burrough for his PhD research. That's the White Horse, which is an Iron Age artifact not far south of Oxford, and cut into the chalk by Hillfort. This was one of Peter Burrough's special survey areas. It's 2 kilometres long, half a kilometre wide, and you can see 100 metre interval grid. And what we've got recorded at each node of the grid is the soil series according to the classification of the Soil Survey of England and Wales. But various properties were also measured on soil samples from these grid nodes. And here we have transformed available potassium. Now, we might well ask whether available potassium is related to the soil series in this landscape or not. It's a sensible question to ask. It might be because their parent material effects, which will affect the potassium exchange and the amount of native potassium. But as you see, it's also a fairly intensively managed landscape, and it may well be that farmers putting fertilizer on their fields has completely swamped any of these effects. So a sensible question to ask is there a difference between these MAP units with respect to soil available potassium? Now, we need to do an analysis then. We can't just do it by a straightforward ANOVAR because we can't assume independence of the residuals, because we've not sampled independently at random, but because we've sampled on a regular 100-meter grid, because this was part of a study to evaluate soil survey procedures. So what I want to show you is a model-based analysis procedure. Because I saw that the conference was taking the very enlightened step of making these presentations available, I just dumped a whole load of R code onto it on the basis you could go away and have a look at it later. It wasn't to read now or to try and frantically scribble down. But basically, I'm using NR, for which I would, strongly recommend everyone here to get to know if they don't already. And I'm using the nonlinear mixed effects models library. Data in a data frame, and what the data include are the coordinates of the locations, along with the log transformed potassium and the soil as a categorical variable. So I fit initially a null model, and effectively, that's assuming independence. So it says there's no spatial dependence. This is equivalent to just doing a standard ANOVAR. And then what I do is update that by applying a spatial correlation model, spherical or exponential. There are other options available. And then I can summarize these two models. This is spherical, the exponential, and I can look at the likelihoods and compare those directly because the number of parameters are the same. And you see you have a much larger likelihood, or significantly larger anyway, for the exponential model, which I will therefore select. So this model here that's been produced by updating the null model is now accounting for the spatial dependence. It's modeled the spatial dependence and the residuals. So I can use the ANOVAR command again to get a summary out. And what you see is that we have actually very weak evidence. We have no evidence, in fact, for differences among those soil series, which, again, is not surprising because there's been so much fertilizer application. That's almost certainly the dominant source of variation. But let's just have a peek at what that model, that null model, said. ANOVAR on the null model, this is equivalent to what you'd have done if you plugged this into ANOVAR in Excel. And what we find, actually, it thinks there's very strong evidence for differences between those MAP units. Now, I have to say, quite often, it's not often that you get such a dramatic effect of using a model-based rather than a design-based analysis on a model-based sample. And I think it's a nice and salutary example. If we'd taken those data and just plugged them into a standard ANOVAR, we'd have come up with a conclusion that looks decidedly non-robust when we start taking a more sophisticated approach. I hope there's sweaty palms in the audience after that strong example. Right, so what then to do after all that? This would almost fit onto my European bumper sticker, deal with spatial dependence in the soil by designing it out of your analysis. And what you can't design, model. That really is the take-home message. So what then to do in some more specific cases? Firstly, the clean sheet of paper where you're starting out from scratch. Make sure that you are clear about your objectives. And often that means make sure that your colleagues are also clear about their objectives. If it's estimating global means, mean values, overall regression coefficients perhaps, then design-based sampling and analysis is design unbiased, straightforward assumptions of independence. There are some cases, and particular monitoring problems, where a hybrid design has advantages. This is design-based in space, so you're selecting random sample points, but then model-based in time. And I'm sure you can see logistically that makes sense. Imagine saying, we've got these random points in space and we're going to visit them on random days, and that would make our lives very difficult. But we can do model-based analysis just in space with the advantages of design-based in time. And this is really a finding that Dick Bruce has been reporting from his work at Wageningen. And there's a paper, I believe, coming out in Geoderma on this. Model-based analysis after design-based sampling can sometimes have advantages. So you don't want to mix them up in the sense of doing a model-based sampling and then plugging it into design-based, but you can actually do it the other way around, and there are sometimes advantages, particularly in field experiments, to try doing some modelling of the random variation post hoc, and Arthur Gilmore and colleagues in Australia have published an interesting paper on that. If your objectives are to do, by contrast, with local prediction or mapping, then you need to be thinking about a sample grid with some shorter range points to help with your modelling of the variogram. If your interest is in scientific study of spatial variation, then I'm very much in favour of using spatially nested sampling. It's very useful. It's very efficient to apply in practice. It is effectively a design-based approach, although, again, you can use model-based methods for analysis, which is sometimes advantageous. It's been in use since 1937, when Uden and Malik used it in New Jersey. And the latest contribution to that methodology, it's still growing and developing, is something I published recently in Computers and Geosciences on optimizing nested spatial sampling designs. What to do with legacy data? Well, only assume independence if you're confident you can fully specify the design. So if someone's lost the design, lost the envelope on the back of which they wrote it, then really you do have some problems, because formally you need to know the inclusion probability of any particular sample site, any potential sample site, and you must fully account for the design in your analysis. If you had stratified random sampling and then dropped the strata, really, you are cheating, because there is a dependence imposed by the stratification that you're then proceeding to ignore. I know of one or two surveys where there was once a stratification that everyone seems to have forgotten about since, and then goes on to analyse the data as if they were simply simple random sampling. And if you can't assume independence, model-based analysis is the solution. So don't ignore independence, it matters. It's always and only justified by how you sample. If you don't know how you sample, don't assume independence. When sampling from scratch, make sure you really know what you're trying to find out. And when analyzing legacy data, use model-based as the most robust approach, unless you really know what the sampling design was. I'd like to finish, as I always do, by thanking people who actually dig the soil at the places we ask them to go and do it. An example there. Thanks to NERC, who fund me for doing the things I do. And if you have been, thank you for listening. One of my hearing aids conked out on the flight across the Atlantic, so I do struggle to hear. Yes, I think that was the point I was making. The paper by Arthur Gilmore, what they found was that obviously, if you've done a design-based experiment, then you can make assumptions of independence and you have design unbiasedness and everything works fine. But what they found was if they actually set out to model spatial structure, they could improve the precision of their estimates accordingly. Now, that requires that you've got enough sample points to model with confidence. So if it was a relatively small survey or small design that experiment, that might not be the case. But you can go in post hoc and model, and there are sometimes advantages in doing that. Yes, you can. And the best way to do it is by residual maximum likelihood, by Rammel. Gower provided, back sometime in the 1950s, I think, or early 60s, a way to estimate variance components from unbalanced designs by a method of moments. But, in fact, residual maximum likelihood, as the NLME package and R will allow you to do, allows you to obtain perfectly valid estimates of variance components from unbalanced nested sampling schemes. And in fact, and this is going really to the paper that I referred to, in general, unbalanced schemes are much more efficient than balanced ones for spatially nested design, because if you have a balanced nested design, you have lots of degrees of freedom at your finer spatial scales. And if you want to add an extra scale, you have to double your sample size. Whereas an unbalanced scheme allows you to come up with a more rational distribution of degrees of freedom, or indeed to optimize the design in some ways. But the best way to analyze it is by residual maximum likelihood, because that was really initially designed for dealing with unbalanced cases.
You didn't talk about anisotropy, for example, of the image, but it appeared to me there probably was anisotropy in it. And then your example was probably the worst case example, which you had the transect. What if you had tried that with proximity along the same transect, but the orientation being random itself?
Right. Well, the point of the modeling in the second... Well, okay, sorry, you're thinking about the analysis from the sample. Yes. Well, I would never try to model anisotropy on the basis of 45 observations anyway. So I think there's always, in modeling, as our first speaker said, models are always wrong, but sometimes useful. And what I think you always have to do is tailor the complexity of your model to the amount of data you've got to model with. So if you were doing a model-based analysis on a relatively small data set like that, I wouldn't add in an extra parameter. And my concern is not, in that case, to model an isotropy, then to use it for prediction. It's simply to come up with a reasonable model of the spatial dependence of the observations. But in the Rammel context, there's no reason not to add an isotropy, and recent work at Adelaide has shown that you can estimate anisotropy parameters relatively easily in terms of the behavior of the likelihood function, the number of samples you do require, although it's, as I say, I wouldn't try with just 40 or 50. There's another point about it. Oh, yes, and in terms of inference as to whether you need it or not, it's a standard case for using the log likelihood ratio. So, yes, you can happily build an isotropy in, provided, as I say, you've got sufficient data. And you need to think a bit about your sampling. If you were really out to do it, as you say, you wouldn't just be running transects in one direction.
So you sort of the pattern communication. Totally agree with you that you should have clear objectives, but often nowadays they ask you to make a map first and then sort of give, so with a map you get the local mean, the local values, and then sort of estimate for regions, for countries for instance, the global mean, and then sort of you run into trouble because you made a map on a grid and then you want sort of to you want to assume independence for areas of your map. Is that at all possible?
I think what I'd do in those circumstances would be to use the Bloch-Kriging estimator. If you were then told, well, say if you had basically a systematic survey and then were told to come up with estimates for, say, a particular land use, then something comparable to the Bloch-Kriging estimator would be. Would be the way to do it.
The Bloch-Kriging gives you the variance then, no?
Yeah.
And can you then sort of calculate the standard error from that variance?
Yeah.
Mm. What do you put as an N then?
You don't. You've got a direct calculation of the mean squared error of the prediction as part of your Bloch-Kriging estimate.